Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. Exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. The UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. The National Life Group, which lives its values every day to do good, be good, make good. Also by Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and ski erg. Quality machines and quality exercise for all ages and abilities. And by Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy innovations while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power, as well as over 750 VBSR members. Here's David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. This week, we're talking about the new face of homelessness in Vermont. Vermont has the highest rate of homelessness in New England. At least two-thirds of Vermont households do not earn enough to afford the average fair market rent. That's according to the Committee on Temporary Shelter, or COTS. The problem seems to be getting worse. A survey last year revealed that Vermont's homeless population rose by 9%. Well, here to talk about homelessness and the challenges around affordable housing in Vermont, we're joined on the show by Becky Holt. She is the Director of Development and Communications for the Committee on Temporary Shelter, and also by Janet Green, who's the Assistant Director of Rental Assistance for the Burlington Housing Authority, where she has worked since 2011. We're also joined by Melissa, a woman who has personal experience being homeless and struggling to afford housing in Vermont. Let's begin with Becky Holt from COTS. Becky, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much for having us today. I'm very pleased to be invited here today.
So, Becky, give us a picture of what homelessness in Vermont, what it currently looks like. What is the scope of the problem?
Well, I would say that there is no one face of homelessness, and one of the things that has struck me in the time I've working at COTS for the last 5 years is that that when I think I know what the face of homelessness looks like, I'm reminded that it's much, you know, that it's not, that it's more complicated. And, you know, we serve people who are single adults, we serve children, we serve families, we serve veterans, we serve elderly, there's babies. So and there's a lot of different ways to look at it, you know, lots of different ways to look at that face of homelessness.
So in terms of the work that COTS does, tell us what the work that COTS does.
COTS was founded more than 30 years ago, and it does a variety of services that goes from a spectrum from emergency shelter for both single adults and for families, as well as transitional and permanent housing, as well as prevention programs for people who are at risk of becoming homeless to try to help them avert the crisis of homelessness altogether.
How has demand for the services of COTS changed?
Since the recession, I came to work for COTS after the recession, and so the experience I've had here is that in that time is that immediately following the recession, the needs really spiked to unprecedented levels, and the new normal is much higher than it was pre-recession. So there's just a greater amount of people who are struggling to stay stable in this economy.
How does the supply of temporary housing match up with the demand?
That's a good question. I think that there are people who need more housing than housing that's available that they can afford. So that's a challenge of finding for wages and salaries and availability of, you know, in Burlington, for example, we have usually less than 1% vacancy rate. At its best, it's maybe 1 or 2% vacancy rate, which is, you know, on line with Manhattan. So it's very difficult to find housing here.
And On your website, it notes that the average fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Chittenden County is $1,015, which is 44% higher than the national average. And the wages required to afford that rent are $19.48 an hour, or $40,500 a year. That's a pretty stunning figure.
It is. The idea of sometimes is that you're here in the community or in just in general at large from your family or whatever, is that, well, if people had a job, if they got to work, and one of the things that stuns people is we have a lot of people who are working. They're quote unquote doing all the right things that should make them not at risk of becoming homeless. But when you have a very expensive place to live, it's a very big challenge, and it doesn't take much to push you over the edge if you're living that close to it.
And, you know, I have to say my own, that aligns with my own experience. My first job out of college back in the 80s was working as a staff person at a homeless shelter in Cambridge, Mass. And the enduring image and feeling that I had at that job was how little separated me from the clients in terms of the stories that they came to me with. These did not fit stereotypical images of who is homeless. Oftentimes, it was somebody who had, you know, a relatively minor thing happen. Perhaps they got injured on a job. Maybe they lost a job, but they had no safety net to catch them. And the only difference between, you know, perhaps me and them was that, you know, I didn't have a sense that if I fell, I'd fall and hit the bottom right away. There, somebody would catch me, and for these folks, there just simply wasn't that somebody, and they were in the shelter I was working in.
No, absolutely, I too have seen that, and that's always in my own life. Before I came to work for COTS, and one of the reasons that actually drew me to change careers and work for COTS was, my mother had passed away from cancer, and, you know, my parents had good insurance, my dad had a good job, my mom had a good job, and the debt from that my dad incurred, you know, after my mom's passing, from the drugs that weren't covered, you know, that were trying to make the end of her life more pleasant, were just astronomically expensive, and it really put my father, he had to refinance the mortgage to lower the mortgage payment because his housing was at risk, and that was something he could have never imagined actually happening to him.
What has something that has surprised you in your job working at COTS now? Something you didn't really know about homelessness?
I think the thing that, you know, one of the things that surprised me the most is before I came here, I knew that COTS served homeless families. I knew that there were homeless children. But the very first day that I worked here, I heard a baby crying. A family was here to meet with, for services. And when I saw a baby, it just stunned me. And that is the thing that surprises me over and over again, and how courageous people who, particularly children, are who are struggling with this. When we do speakers bureaus, when we, you know, we're invited to go speak to a class, I've had it happen several times, not just once, more than once, and every time it still is astonishing, is when a child will self-identify after I give a talk about what COTS does and what homelessness is, self-identify to their classmates that they are either with us at that time or have stayed with COTS before, and they know what homelessness feels like and what it really is like, and I just am... That always gets me. Like I know the statistics, I know the data, I know the reality of the services, but when I actually meet a child, that still gets me every time.
Well, let's bring into the conversation Janet Green. Janet is the Assistant Director of Rental Assistance for the Burlington Housing Authority, where she's worked since 2011. And a big part of Green's job is to manage the authority's housing for homeless people. Janet, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So recently you wrote a letter to the Burlington Free Press regarding their coverage of homelessness. And your letter said, quote, "I was disappointed in your coverage of family homelessness in Vermont. I did not see any mention of the complex reasons why families become homeless." Could you tell us what are you referring to there? What was missing in the Free Press's coverage?
I think what inspired me to contact the Free Press was that it didn't seem plausible that there was only one reason for homelessness. I thought that the article missed covering the complexities of the issue and the many different reasons that I see families and individuals who are homeless coming into Burlington Housing Authority, and certainly through all my time working with COTS and on projects that involve trying to end homelessness in the community. There was no mention of generational poverty. There wasn't any mentions of domestic violence, the opiate epidemic, or the number of children who are in the state's custody, or families and individuals that return from incarceration. So I just felt that it was important to share some of that information. I really believe in person-specific data when it comes to ways and solutions to end homelessness. So the more that I have been learning about that and participating in efforts to get a really specific handle on who it is in our community that are homeless, I wanted to reach out and express those new concepts and, you know, communicate that there was a lot more to it.
What do you mean by person-specific data about homelessness?
Person-specific data is actually, as a community, going out and trying to identify every one of our homeless neighbors by name. There are tools that have been developed that help to take information and find the most vulnerable among us and use that information to create housing placement strategies. So it's really getting up and going out, as we did as a community last fall, and finding everyone who is in our community who is without housing and knowing them by name. And this method, you know, person-specific data is the way to end homelessness. And so in this way, when you have the names and information from people of what their needs are, you're able to house them. And we found over 200 individuals that are homeless and since then have been able to house 36 of our most vulnerable neighbors in permanent supportive housing. So that concept is very powerful and important, and so that's some of the effort that hopefully we can also bring and extend to the families that are homeless to really know who they are and what the needs are and then bring them to housing and housing resources.
How do you find homeless people to take a census of them? I mean, you know, as we've mentioned here, it's not necessarily the stereotypical image of somebody sleeping in the street.
Right. Well, we do the best we can. We started with unsheltered individuals who are the most vulnerable and more likely to die being out on the street, who have medical complications, substance abuse, or mental health issues. We, in terms of families, would go to, we did go to shelter. We would ask that people who know that there are unsheltered families living in cars or in camps would bring them, we would be brought to them so that we can conduct a survey with them. We worked with the homeless school liaisons last spring and went to them and asked them to be in touch with us if they have families that they are aware of who are homeless, to just get to know who they are and if they're eligible for housing and how we might take some action around their situations. So that's the way. I mean, it's not easy to count people that are homeless. It's not, you know, always a thing that you can do in a quick way, but it's a community effort. And from my experience, it really does make a difference. Numbers will tell you numbers, and we do that through this annual count called the Point in Time Count. But unless you know who people are, then it's really difficult to figure out solutions with them.
You told the Burlington Free Press that rarely, if ever, do I encounter families who are homeless due solely to economic reasons. So I mean, that's a pretty surprising statement. What are the more common or the most common reasons that you find for people becoming homeless?
Well, the programs that I manage at Burlington Housing are targeted to families that are homeless. So I see families that are involved in the child welfare system. I'm working with partners like Howard, Pathways to Housing, Vermont Cares, Spectrum, Lund, COTS. So I'm meeting families who these programs are targeted to. Our wait lists, unfortunately, for families and individuals who are just waiting solely for economic reasons are extremely long. I meet the families who have complicated issues, health conditions, mental health, substance abuse. So it's rarely just economic. It typically is a number of reasons that bring them to the programs that I manage. And affordability is a piece of it. And when I say affordability, I like to try to be clear because, you know, affordability to whom? As Becky pointed out, you know, there or maybe you had said, there's certain amounts of money that you would have to make to afford an apartment without rental assistance. And that's not an easy thing for many people who are just working at wages, you know, that make $10-$11 an hour. My point in reaching out to the Free Press was just to illuminate that money is a piece of the issue, but that there's a lot more to it, and it's not a simple fix.
So if you were to describe to people what the real face or faces or perhaps the most typical face of homelessness that you encounter, how would you describe that?
Well, I think I'd go to the data. You know, as I said, it's not easy to count homeless people, but we do agree as a community that we use something that we're required to do on an annual basis called the point in time count. And when I look at that, I see and experience myself chronically homeless individuals who suffer from mental health issues and have substance abuse. That's what the data shows, that it's individuals who are chronically homeless, meaning that they cycle in and out of episodes of homelessness or who have been homeless for really, really long lengths of time. I work with families who are involved in the child welfare system, so I also see families who are dealing with their own issues around substance abuse or having been involved in the correctional system, mental health. So that's another group that I encounter. The data that I work with from the count that we did last fall is individuals and also from point in time, I, you know, look at the data from the state about who's asking for motels, and again, that's showing domestic violence, child abuse, chronic homelessness, being kicked out of family and friends from where they were staying, or evictions. You know, that's a lot of the experience that I'm working with in my day-to-day work, as well as a community and trying to figure out who's out there. We're very interested in knowing more about families, those numbers, and who that is, and how we can reach out to them and try to come up with some solutions around their housing needs.
David, I think that's I think Janet brings up a really interesting point about the data that I'd just like to jump in on and say, you know, I think it's really hard. She's absolutely right. I mean, there's so many different ways to look and at the data and slice it and to try to get a picture of it. And that is one of the things that I find fascinating, you know, having spent 20 years as a journalist, that I just love to look at the facts and the data and the information and the different ways that you can try to get a full picture of an issue. And the point in time is a great tool for giving you a snapshot, particularly of as Janet said, chronically homeless and single adults. I mean, it just is, and that's been one of the interesting things is that the U.S. Department of Education and the Vermont Agency of Education really look at family homelessness because it is hard because they're not on the street, and they look at them through the schools and through the homeless liaisons, and that's where you can get a sense of the family homelessness crisis, which doesn't really show up in the point in time where you might have where it is someone who's maybe on the street, literally, as opposed to a family who's doubled up or, you know, sleeping in a unheated basement or something to that effect.
So your point is that homelessness is very undercounted.
In some ways, I mean, I think it's sometimes really hard, you know, to get that full picture from that because of where, how the issue manifests in different faces, you know. So I think that's I think the data is really compelling and really interesting, and I think it's important to look at it that way. And I think it's, you know, I really commend Janet for trying to get a better idea of it. And that's one of the things that I just love about, you know, I tend to drive our own data people crazy, like looking to crunch the numbers slightly different or slice them, you know, to look at what we know about the issues that she was alluding to, you know, beyond financial. And absolutely, I always describe it in talks that homelessness you could look at homelessness as a ladder, and at the top of the ladder is someone who's experiencing a financial crisis. And getting them back to the top of the ladder, which is housing stably, is really a financial issue. And that's where prevention, I think, is really key, because I think you can, a lot of times with a small and a short-term intervention, really change the trajectory of a family or an individual if you're able to intervene early in the process. However, all the way down to the bottom of the ladder, you have someone who is struggling with chronic homelessness, with years of potentially having the length of time being homeless, perhaps struggling with lots of complicating factors like addiction or mental illness, and that's at the other extreme. And in between is a whole lot of other variations and causes. It's not, you know, Janet's absolutely right that there's not just one cause of homelessness, and it's and depending on what combination of factors a family or an individual is struggling with, it can result in how you respond to the issue and how you respond to it. And I think that's one of the things that I find fascinating in our community and with working at COTS, is that I see how that plays out. You know, that's one of the things I like about looking at the prevention data, because when you're able to intervene earlier and quicker in the process, you can hopefully avert that next generation of chronic homelessness and really change the trajectory for that individual or parent, but also for their children and the subsequent generations too.
So Becky Holtz from COTS, as we talk about the complexities that underlie what lands somebody in a situation of homelessness, what have you seen works in the work that you're doing?
I think there's different things. I mean, I think that's, I think some of the things that we've seen is looking at prevention in different ways. You know, is it prevention through, rapid rehousing? Is it prevention through, which is a part of the component, reducing the time that someone is becoming homeless, potentially reducing their risk of becoming homeless again? Prevention through intervening with children in shelter, doing lots of, you know, we work with the school districts on doing tutoring in shelter, you know, that kind of intervening and connecting closely with to try to provide the supports for children so we reduce the trauma on them while they're in shelter if they have become homeless. There's all sorts of different things, helping families rebuild credit, connecting them with community partners like CVOEO's Financial Futures Program to help them, you know, improve budgeting skills. So it's different. It's looking at the individual or their family and looking at what their unique issues are and then crafting a solution. When I first started working at COTS 5 years ago, it was really easy in some ways to classify someone was helped by shelter, someone was helped by prevention, someone was helped by rehousing. But the services now, I would say, are far more nuanced, because it's not one solution, and it's looking at the family and looking to what Janet was saying, at the different issues that a family is facing or is a single adult, and then crafting the solution and the right mix of services, either with COTS and or with our partners, to help them. And I think that's really, I'm always amazed and impressed by the work our staff does who do that. You know, the direct service, their ability to know. It's like I was an RA in college, and one of the things I talked about being in a residence hall and being in a dorm was I didn't become an RA until I was a junior and a senior in college. And had I known about all the great resources that were available on a campus as a freshman, it would have probably transformed my entire college experience. I had a great college experience, but I look at that, our staff, they know those resources. They know the laws. They know the abilities. They know the great community partners, and they're able to help people navigate that.
Okay, so we're going to take a break here. We're talking with Becky Holt from Committee on Temporary Shelter, Janet Green from Burlington Housing Authority. We're talking about homelessness. And when we come back, we'll speak with a woman who has personal experience of homelessness in Vermont.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to provide David Goodman's Vermont Conversations with underwriting from National Life Group, Concept 2, Green Mountain Power, The Alchemist, and UVM Medical Center, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. Our topic this week is homelessness. And at the top of the show, I recounted some of the basics of the of homelessness in Vermont. Vermont has the highest rate of homelessness in New England, and at least two-thirds of Vermont households do not earn enough to afford the average fair market rent. Well, to tell us a little bit about the human face of those numbers, we're joined by Melissa, who has personal experience of being homeless and dealing with the challenge of affording housing in Vermont. Melissa, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So share with us a little of your story, and particularly as it relates to housing.
I was homeless. Well, in 2005, that was because I lost my kids to a drug addiction. So I was couch surfing for about a year, and then I got pregnant and decided that I didn't want to use drugs anymore, and I wanted to have a good life for me and my children. So I went to the Lund home, and I stayed there for about a year. I did all my classes and everything I needed to, so it was time for me to leave. So after that, I had couch surfed for about another year with my six-month-old. That wasn't as bad as it was after that because I did have a place to stay for a little while. Then when I moved out of there, it started getting a little rough because I was going to economic services and getting help with hotels where they would help me for a week or 2 weeks, and then I would have to go back. So that meaning I'd have to lug all my belongings, you know, some of my kids' toys on the bus in the wintertime with him, sit at Pathways with my child half the day waiting to be seen until I can get a hotel room. And sometimes that could take up to a couple hours after I left PATH to find out where I would be placed. So it was a little bit of a struggle doing that. And then I was at another place where you have to leave in the morning. So worrying about where I was going to go from day to day with my child, that was probably my biggest challenge.
What is your situation now?
When I was at Lund, I had told my story to a CCV class, and a guy from Burlington Housing was in that class. So when I left, I got a call from COTS, a worker that I'm working with there, saying that this guy had wanting to meet with me. So I met with him, and he recognized me from that meeting, so he advocated for me to get a Section 8 voucher, and that went through thanks to him.
So you mentioned the Lund home. What is that?
That's for families to go. Multiple different reasons. I went there because of drug use, but there is other people there that go because they need mental health, parenting, or just new moms.
What led you, Melissa, to use drugs?
I think the people I was hanging around, more or less, I just wanted to do it. I didn't really have no reason. But then when I did do it, you know, it's really hard to stop.
What kind of drugs are we talking about?
Crack cocaine.
And how quickly do you get hooked when you start using?
Pretty easily. That's why since I've been sober about 3 years. I still have all my supports, even though I do have a Section 8 voucher and I am housed right now. And I keep those supports in place just in case I ever get overwhelmed with a lot of stuff. I have them just, you know, replaced to using.
So it sounds like you've benefited from, you know, a variety of interventions from the Lund home to the Burlington Housing Authority. What would, as you look back on, and what is the span of years we're talking about? When did this whole cycle of homelessness begin for you?
Probably 2006.
And when did you finally get secure housing?
For my own apartment a year ago.
And how old are you now?
I'm 28.
And do you have your children back?
I have two children. The other ones that I had lost in 2005, I do not have because of that. And I didn't know how to stay sober on my own. Rehab wasn't doing anything for me. Well, they did, but, you know, I wasn't willing to stay sober when I had left rehab. Lund was my only option. I really needed something long-term. So yeah. I do have the two that I had since I've been at Lund.
I'm just curious, we're having this conversation, you know, a short time after this tragedy in Barrie where that DCF worker was killed. What insights do you have on, you know, your interactions with DCF and what, you know, might have led this woman who allegedly killed her family and this DCF worker?
Well, I don't think it's no excuse for murder. You know, I've had some fallouts with DCF in the past. I feel like they made some bad choices on taking my kids, not for the drug use, but like for some other things, you know, like hearsay and stuff. But I currently do have DCF involved right now for hearsay. And they actually are been really incredible this time around. They know I'm trying. They know I've been very successful in the last 3 years since I've been at Lund. And they're staying in my life just to continue to watch me grow and to make sure I have all these things in place, like for my child, because my child is kind of have a lot of behaviors and stuff. So they're making sure I take the right steps on getting him the help he needs as well as the help I need.
So from your perspective, DCF in these last few years has been helpful to you?
Yeah.
What has been kind of a key to taking you out of, you know, to getting you stabilized?
In the past?
Just, you know, in recent times. It sounds like you're in one of the more stable stretches of your, you know, of your life in your 20s right now.
I realized that, when I went to Lund, I realized, you know, enough's enough. I know that I'm probably not wanting any more kids in the future. I'm pregnant, you know. I wanted to get clean, have a good life, and actually have my kids and be able to be a mother that I always dreamed of being. And now that I have my voucher, it's really helped me out a lot. I mean, I still have some struggles where I can't find a job because of childcare. And credit was my big barrier, too, on, like, finding housing, like, in a more appropriate housing, like, through Champlain Housing or subsidized because of the credit and stuff. I want a nicer place for my children with a backyard. Where I'm living now, don't get me wrong, I'm very grateful to have an apartment, but it's just not a good environment, kind of, to raise a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old. There's a main road right there. My son always wants to go. So, yeah, I'm just very grateful to have these supports in place.
And is there... tell me a little bit about your family background. Are these kinds of economic and mental health struggles, is this something that your parents have also struggled with?
My dad is an alcoholic and my mom is a drug user. My family is pretty much currently homeless now. My dad lives with my sister, and my mom's just always been off and on, pretty much making same mistakes and stuff. So yeah, I really didn't learn a lot from them growing up and stuff, but seeing their life now and stuff, I don't want to be 40 and have no place to live or not be able to have my kids in my life or still be using. I want to actually go somewhere in life.
So what do you see for yourself as the route to breaking this cycle of poverty and homelessness?
Just keep doing what I'm doing. I mean, reaching out when I need the help. I live in Vermont my whole life, so I know all my resources if I ever need anything. And right now I'm moving into a nicer place. because of Section 8 helped me get appeal through Champlain Housing and stuff. So I'm just hoping that I just keep these people in place, and I know that I can keep going forward instead of going backwards.
You mentioned that you're currently without a job.
Yeah, I'm currently without a job. I was working for a year last year, and then because of my son's behaviors, he was asked to leave his child care, and that's just been a really big issue. In the past year, trying to work with him on his behavior issues, and I've been having, like, a lot of support. When I say a lot, I mean, like, six different workers come to my house a week. We just work on his behavior and stuff, and but he starts preschool in a couple weeks, but that's only going to be a few hours a day. So that just is a big barrier to being able to find a job right now.
Where do you see yourself being in, say, 5 years from now?
I don't know. I've been doing a lot of thinking about it over the year, and I kind of want to be a drug and alcohol counselor because that's something that I'm familiar with.
Okay. Well, let me turn a question back to Janet Green from the Burlington Housing Authority. Janet, this year, Governor Shumlin and Human Services Secretary Hal Cohen launched a statewide initiative to end child and family homelessness in Vermont by 2020. Can you talk about what that plan is, and is that really possible that we could end child and family homelessness in 5 years?
I think it is. I think that we have a very manageable homelessness issue in our state relative to the kinds of numbers you would see in bigger cities or in bigger states around the country. I'd have to say that the plan, in my opinion, is pretty boilerplate. I think it was taken from sort of a national framework. And again, I'm always going to tie it back to the data. I don't think until we have very good information and the real stories, like the lived experience that Melissa shared, that you can begin to really develop the kind of strategy that would be able to lead us to ending this issue in 5 years. When numbers or percentages are presented in the legislature and are discussed, or just reasons, it doesn't bring it to the reality of who the people are, what their barriers might be, and how you design programs that would really make a difference. And I think the data is critical, and as is hearing from the voices of those who are experiencing homelessness and learning more about what they think might work.
So in Melissa's story, she described a very intensive level of support. She was just telling us five or six people may come to her home in a week.
Right.
And so, you know, this is also a time we're hearing of, you know, a lot of cutbacks in government services, whether it's federal or state level. Have there been cuts that have been particularly problematic and translated into a rise in homelessness?
I don't think so. I think the interesting thing for me that I contemplate is working with families who are in housing and really trying to ensure that they're successful there. Our current system actually focuses on an emergency crisis response. There's a lot of resources and prioritization to shelter, to motels, and if that could be redirected to actually supporting families and individuals while they're in housing, I think that that would potentially turn and shift us to be more in a direction that other communities are headed in, and in a direction that would allow us to really maximize the resources that are available to us in the state. I think that it's important for people to realize that once someone's housed, the story doesn't end there. It can sometimes be the beginning of a lot of need and support. It can be very overwhelming to run a household for any of us, and to be doing that with lots of children, or when you're struggling with a mental health issue, or it's new to you because you haven't been housed in many, many years, the focus could really be there, and to help make sure that people don't fall back into these episodes of homelessness. And sometimes it doesn't take just one try. Sometimes it takes, you know, another. So really making sure that we have a good understanding of prevention beyond the financial assistance and putting supports in place that work. We try to really promote that at Burlington Housing and have advocated. We have many tenants in our buildings and through our rental assistance programs, and I think Melissa did an excellent job of articulating how support can and knowing who to call and what resources out there are really important for people to maintain their housing and be successful.
In a case such as Melissa's, with the supports that she has, Section 8 subsidized housing and, mm-hmm. and such, how long will that last?
Well, the federal subsidy is hers. She would, you know, have it unless there were, you know, program violations or lease violations, or you know, if she earns enough income to eventually move off the program. But there's a lot of potential with a Section 8 voucher, that we have a home ownership program. So it's a really valuable thing to have and to be able to obtain. And once someone has it, we have a family self-sufficiency program. We have a lot of things and opportunity that you can continue to build on. So she will have the rental assistance. And I would say in terms of the social supports, sometimes those kinds of services end because of criteria and eligibility. People are done with their work, so those might not be in place. But I think if someone reached out and you know, wanted community members or mentors to continue to participate, that's something that would be available to them. But on our end, the rental assistance is for her and her family until she either earns enough money where she isn't eligible for assistance. But other than that, it's something she could have to provide for herself and for her kids for a lifetime.
Could we just put some numbers to this? I mentioned earlier that the average fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Chittenden County is just over $1,000. What does Section 8 do to that monthly rate?
Well, a person on Section 8 pays 30% of their income, and currently we have something called a payment standard. So a two-bedroom payment standard is $1,309, which includes utilities. So that means that someone who's a voucher holder would have to look for housing that doesn't exceed that amount. And that can be slightly different depending on the utilities and if the person has you know, employment income. But just as a range, a two-bedroom payment standard for Section 8 in our service jurisdiction is $1,309.
So that's actually, you're saying that's what a client would pay out of pocket?
No, that's the amount of the apartment that they could look for in total rent and utilities. They would be paying 30% of their income. So in Melissa's case, or in anyone who's, say, receiving REACHUP, their amount is about $223, and we provide what's known as a housing assistance payment for the remaining balance.
Hmm. How do you avoid what's known as the benefits cliff, where people have a disincentive to get off of assistance because of the sharp drop in you know, in the kind of support that they would have?
Right, because we're an income-based program, so if you increase your earnings, we reduce what we would assist you with. And of course, across the board, that would go for potentially a REACHUP grant or food stamps, so there's a lot of impact. I think the benefits cliff needs a lot more coordination so that folks can really recognize if they're earning more money through increase of hours, what the impacts would be, and to have enough time to prepare for that. They tend to happen, those changes, pretty quickly, and oftentimes you're expected to pay more for certain things, but you haven't even received the first paycheck of that amount that you will be getting should you have increased hours or your income changing somewhat. So I think the coordination of the different types of assistance people are involved in could be improved to try to avoid some of that. And obviously we're encouraging and supportive of folks earning more and being able to take on more of the rent themselves and reducing the amount that we assist with. it would increase the amount of people we're able to assist, and they could be enrolled in other programs that help them put that difference away in escrow accounts that they could later use for education or different goals that they might have.
Becky Holt from the Committee on Temporary Shelter, can you talk a little bit about special categories of homelessness, namely veterans and also homeless students? I read that from 2010 to 2012, Vermont's homeless student population grew by 35%, one of the sharpest increases in the country.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting, and at COTS, we look at to try to find the right solution and the right mix of services. We look at it through different lenses and different data points and also service points. So our services for families and students and children can be different than what our services are for veterans or for adults. And sometimes there's overlap between all of those. But, for example, at COTS, we have two family shelters, and we have special enrichment programs in shelter for children specifically. We work with tutoring in shelter. We have a AmeriCorps serving directly in shelter who works with health and wellness to help families who, to address obesity and the food scarcity, and to try to have families when they're in shelter learn how to or get experience budgeting for and to be able to get, the better food that costs more money, but the benefits to their children of eating more vegetables and how you can make that possible. In fact, we have this beautiful kitchen garden this summer that the kids have embraced. They collect stickers for trying new vegetables, and so they are very into this, and it has really been a really positive thing. Also reduce the costs of the food and that we serve for healthy, nutritious food for children in shelter through the garden. But veterans is also, we also have special programming for veterans. Nationally, I think they say that the number of that veterans make up about 30% of the overall national homeless population, which I will give the government credit. In the last few years, they have really worked to step up addressing that and made efforts to end that, because if someone has served our country, they should never have to experience homelessness, because there aren't the resources able to help them when they return home. And so we actually, our Canal Street Veterans Housing is a program specifically for veterans that we did in partnership with Housing Vermont. And it's actually coming up on its fifth anniversary in January of 2016. And it was really interesting because we just got this report back from the VA on some of the results that we've had in 5 years on our program-specific veterans. And it's been really great because 73% of the veterans at Canal Street have reached or made significant progress toward their educational goals. 93% made progress or attained their employment goals. So there's unique programming depending to address specific, unique needs among the different populations. Because I think it's important to what you were talking about with the benefits cliff of, how do you, we're as much about fighting apathy as we are about creating solution. And how do you create programs that address the benefits cliff and help people, empower people for the aspirational, as opposed to feeling like, because there is a fear, I think there was, when Melissa, she kind of alluded to it a little bit, I think, when she was talking about not wanting to lose the resources, and that is critical for families. It's as a working mom myself, I know how hard it is if you're afraid that you're going to lose your child care resource or your, it can be a house of cards for anyone trying to keep it all together when you have children and keeping it all together. So those resources can be incredibly supportive and wonderful and helpful, but it can be very scary to risk losing them. And so how do you develop programs? And that's something certainly that we are looking at, because how do you help people fight that and feel empowered to make those changes and aspire, but also not risk destabilizing their family and their household? So
for somebody who finds themselves in a, at risk of losing their housing or concerned about that, where can they turn?
I think when you are afraid, you can call COTS. And if we are not always the right solution for everyone, but we are a good place to start. And
then, you know, from there, it's connecting to the right resources. Maybe Howard is the better fit. We work closely with our partners like Champlain Housing Trust and CVOEO and other organizations to Lund, of course, and Women Helping Battered Women. And so finding the right solution for, you know, there's a lot of really great resources in our community, and the COTS is a good place to start if you don't know where else to go.
And where do they find info on COTS?
You can go to COTSonline.org, or you can call us at 864-7402.
And Melissa, as somebody who has been homeless and has been helped, what advice would you pass on to somebody out there who is at risk of, you know, or who is in a very precarious housing situation?
I would say reach out to all the supports you can get. I mean, there's not really much advice that I can give other than that. That's the only thing I could have done in the past. Just talk to people, you know, see what other supports or resources are out there that you can get help with.
And what gives you hope, Melissa?
Keeping these supports in place and most of all my kids.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank all of you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation to talk about the face of homelessness in Vermont.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Becky Hult from the Committee on Temporary Shelter, Janet Green from the Burlington Housing Authority, and Melissa, who has herself been homeless. That does it for the Vermont Conversation this week. This and all shows are on VermontConversation.com. Tune in next Wednesday at 1 for another Vermont Conversation.
You've been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Made possible by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its 750-plus members. Additional support is provided by Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and ski erg. Quality machines, quality exercise for all ages and abilities. The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy innovations while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. By the UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. And by National Life Group, which lives by its values every day. To do good, be good, make good. Tune in next Wednesday, 1 to 2, for Vermont Conversations with David Goodman.
Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire.